The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. I'm Melanie Hildreth. For many listeners, a law enforcement program designed to prevent crimes before they happen sounds like something ripped from the pages of a science fiction novel, not a newspaper. But for residents of Pasco County, Florida, that frightening scenario is all too real. Last fall, the Tampa Bay Times exposed the practice in Pasco, and this spring, the Institute for Justice challenged it in court. I'm here with IJ attorneys Rob Johnson and Ari Bargill to talk about what's happening. Rob, can you start by describing how Pasco County's predictive policing program is designed to function?
Yeah, so the Pasco County Sheriff's Office is making lists of people who a crude computer algorithm predicts are going to commit future unspecified crimes. And then it is harassing those people in their homes and also on the streets, following them around, visiting them untold times, you know, sometimes multiple times a day, certainly multiple times per month or even week, gathering information on them, hassling them, all because it predicts that they're going to commit these, again, unspecified, completely imaginary future crimes. Now, the Pasco County Sheriff's Office calls these people prolific offenders. But to be on the list, you don't have to be prolific. And you don't even necessarily have to be an offender. You know, we know from our investigation that some people on the list are as young as 15 years old. And the algorithm takes into account things like, you know, being arrested, not necessarily convicted, or even being named as a witness in somebody else's police report. And then based on that information, the Pasco County Sheriff's Office is conducting what it calls prolific offender checks. And this means it's coming to your house. It's asking to see the person on the list, to come into the house. They're going around to the backyard. They're peering over the fence. They're looking in the windows. They're asking intrusive questions about people's social networks, what they're posting on Facebook, who they're dating, who their friends are. And then if you don't answer these questions, they're threatening people with what would be essentially pretextual code enforcement. So they're citing people for having long, tall grass, for not having numbers on their mailbox, even for having chickens in their backyards, all because they're not fully cooperating with this dystopian program. And it's even going so far as to arrest people. So the sheriffs arrest people for things like not wearing a seatbelt or for not appearing for a hearing about your tall grass. And then, you know, I think the other sort of like key thing to mention here is the harassment isn't limited just to people on the list. So the sheriff is harassing people just because they're in a family with someone on the list. They're showing up to their house, asking questions about their family members. And again, if the sheriff thinks they're not fully cooperating, then they're subjecting them to the same kind of consequences, the code enforcement, the arrests, and everything that comes with that.
Being on the list has these huge ramifications. And I wanted to talk a little bit more about what gets someone on the list. I know there's a lot about it that's very mysterious. What we do, what do we know about how somebody as young as 15 or 14 could possibly have enough markers on their record or wherever to qualify as a prolific offender?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of it is kind of shrouded in mystery, but we do know some things. So part of it, like I mentioned, you know, they're looking at not just arrests, but also or not just convictions, but also arrests and also even just appearing as a suspect or a witness. They're also looking at things like your social background. You know, they're asking, do you come from a broken home? Do you come from a family where people have committed crimes? You know, what's your socioeconomic background? Are you getting bad grades in school? Things like that. All of that can factor into the decision to put somebody on a list. And then, you know, it's, I think there is sort of an element of discretion to it as well on the part of the sheriff. And obviously that's something that we're very much looking forward to learning more about as the case proceeds and we're able to sit the sheriff down in a deposition and start asking some questions.
You mean they're not immediately forthcoming about the secret that they kind of shake together to get the list?
Well, I think, like I said, we know a lot about how the list is put together, but we definitely have questions about how specific individuals end up on the list.
Ari, I know this sounds horrible in principle. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what it's like in practice. I know you spent a lot of time talking to people who were targeted through the program. What is it like for them? What do they experience as somebody that Pasco has decided is, you know, a potential future criminal?
It's terrifying. And I don't use that word lightly. I use it deliberately because the only way that you can really describe what it's like to be in your home and be the constant subject of attention from police when you've done nothing wrong is terror. And that's in fact what all of our clients felt. It's sort of the unifying term that you hear people use when discussing their experience with the Pasco County Sheriff's Office and this program in particular. And it's part of why IJ felt like we just had to challenge it. And, you know, to get into the specifics of what our clients in this case endured, starting with Robert Jones, he's a hardworking guy. He's got four kids. He relocated to Pasco County, and police came by and said they wanted to speak with his son, informing him that, you know, that this is part of a Scared Straight program that we do, and we'd like to help keep your son on the straight and narrow. And if you'll allow us inside, we'll just chat with him really briefly, and we'll make sure that everything is on the up and up with him. And so Robert said, okay, come on inside, you know, help me out if that's what you're here to do. And they went on in, and they ended up leaving with an empty baggie that they said later tested positive for trace amounts of marijuana. There were no charges pursued in connection with this apparent find, but nevertheless, that landed Robert's son on this list, and he became the subject of regular and repeated and unwanted visits from the Pasco County Sheriff's Office. And each time he asked, are you guys here to investigate a crime? And they told him no. And so he wouldn't let them in. And, you know, if he wasn't there, they'd be banging on the door and banging on windows while his daughters were inside hiding under the bed, afraid of the police. His son was afraid to go out, and he wanted to protect his family. And so he endured the brunt of the Pasco County Sheriff's Office program that was designed in part to target kids. And so he was taking the brunt of this on behalf of his children. And ultimately, former deputies of the Pasco County Sheriff's Office have talked about Robert's case and acknowledged that we couldn't get his kid, so we went after the dad. And so he was arrested multiple times for trivial violations. As Rob mentioned earlier, they would cite him for trivial things like tall grass or not having house numbers, not tell him about hearings on those violations, and then arrest him for missing those hearings. And so finally, all of this kind of culminated several years ago, where after one arrest, he said enough is enough. And in the middle of the night, after getting out of jail, he packed whatever belongings he could. He took his family of six, packed them into a car, and moved them into a hotel under cover of darkness because they were so terrified of the Pasco County Sheriff's Office and what they seemed to be able to get away with. He just felt like there's no way that if they want to get me, they're not going to get me, so I just need to leave. And that's exactly what they did. And his story, unfortunately, is not uncommon. Tammy is another one of our clients. Tammy's son also landed on this list as a 15-year-old. She was the subject of constant harassment. She was arrested for not cooperating with Pasco County deputies' desire to search her home without a warrant. And as a result, she essentially is a convicted felon. She had to take a plea deal because she was on probation, again, as a result of something that the Pasco County Sheriff's Office did to her. When she opened her screen door during one of their warrantless searches and the door hit a deputy and she was charged with battery on a law enforcement officer. And so now, after having spent 76 days in jail stemming from that incident, she had to take a plea deal to get home to her kids in time for Christmas. And so unfortunately now Tammy's a convicted felon as a result of all of this. And the stories go on and on. Tammy, again, as Rob mentioned, was cited for having a chicken in her backyard. She was fined $2,500 for that and for not having house numbers on her mailbox. The degree to which, or the extent to which the Pasco County Sheriff's Office was engaging in pretextual code enforcement was deeply problematic, and that's a central component of our claims in this case.
Yeah, it seems like there is a real bait and switch happening, especially in the instance where you have a family where the officers are coming in sort of purporting or maybe genuine at the beginning, you know, who knows, to want to help. And then it flips and it becomes almost immediately antagonistic. And it seems, you know, as an outsider looking in, well, how could they not eventually, in that dynamic, you're going to make criminals. And that, it sounds like, is what happened to both of the clients. In Robert's case, I mean, he has had no arrests since. Had he had anything on his record before?
As a very young man, I think he had a minor run-in with police, but by no means was he some sort of criminal. And I think you're absolutely right that he never would have ended up in the predicaments that he was in, the legal predicaments that he was in, if not for this program.
So I think the amazing thing about Robert is this is a guy who was dreaming of going to law school. I mean, he was, you know, not just dreaming of it, he was working towards it very concretely when he moved to Pasco, and that was what he wanted to do, and it was a realistic plan. And now he'll tell you, you know, with all of these arrests and even having been charged with crimes by the Pasco Sheriff's Office, you know, crimes that, of course, he was never convicted of, but they still show up on his record as charges. He'll tell you, you know, I look like a criminal. If you pull me up, that's what I look like. And he's had to abandon his dream of going to law school. And it goes to your point. This is a program that is turning, you know, people who may never have done anything wrong, and it's making them, at least on paper, look like they are bad, bad criminal people.
So that obviously, this is a program that has a lot of practical problems, ethical problems, humanitarian problems. It also has legal problems, which is really where IJ brings something special to Pasco County. Can you talk a little bit about what our claims are in the challenge that we brought to the predictive policing program?
So this was a fun case to put together, because when the government comes up with, you know, creative new ways to violate people's constitutional rights, you really have to go back to first principles to figure out, you know, what is it that they're doing wrong. And so as we were thinking about this case, we ultimately realized, you know, at bottom, this is a Fourth Amendment case. And the Fourth Amendment guarantees your right to be secure in your home. And if that means anything, it means that police can't come to your house and repeatedly harass you in your home just because they think you're going to commit some sort of future crime. In a case called Terry versus Ohio, the Supreme Court held that if the police want to stop you on the street and ask you questions, they have to have reasonable suspicion that you've committed a crime. And if the police are going to harass you in your house, they should have to have at least that, if not more. But they don't have anything like that here. They're going off of future crimes, not any kind of suspicion that any crime has already occurred.
So under the law, just to jump in and ask a question about that, the prediction of the program doesn't qualify. Like saying, well, yeah, we have a reason to believe it. Our scientific algorithm here says that you're going to be a problem. So that doesn't cut it?
Yeah, so I have two thoughts about that. One is, you know, it's so, when we hear the word algorithm, we often think, oh, like that's spooky and scary because, you know, the computers are really smart. But I think of this case, it's like it's half Minority Report and it's half Dumb and Dumber. Because the algorithm is just not that sophisticated. It's based on taking a bunch of numbers that are kind of picked out of a hat for, you know, you get this many points for an arrest, this many points for being a witness, and we just add it up and give you a score. And then there's kind of like a spice of human discretion based on your social background and things like that. And it's just not, it's not the, you know, the precogs and Minority Report. It's very different from that. And then, you know, on top of that, I mean, the standard under the Fourth Amendment is, does the government have reasonable suspicion that you've committed a crime, not reasonable suspicion that you're a bad person who might do something bad in the future? That's just not how the Fourth Amendment works.
So that's obviously, that in some ways is probably going to be one of the most familiar kinds of claims, that if we're talking about police coming into somebody's house with no real legitimate reason to do it, that does seem like, you know, Fourth Amendment violation, search and seizure. Is that that's the primary claim in our case?
Well, that's sort of the lead claim. But I think, you know, as we thought about this, there are absolutely other claims that we're very excited about as well. And another one is our procedural due process claim. And, you know, the way I explain this, or I think about it myself, is, you know, that being on this list is kind of like being on probation, but it's probation for a future crime that hasn't happened yet. And if the government's going to put you on probation for a real crime, they give you a hearing first. And if the government's going to put you on probation for these, you know, sort of hypothetical future crimes, then they need to do the same thing. But they're not. You know, they're putting people on these lists without any kind of a hearing. And once you're on the list, there's nothing you can do to challenge it or to try to get yourself taken off. And then we also have claims about the code enforcement. So, you know, we've talked a lot about how they're going after people in a very pretextual way for these sorts of code enforcement issues like tall grass, missing numbers on your mailbox, things like that. And that's an equal protection violation because they're treating people differently simply because they're not complying with the program. And it's also a substantive due process problem because you're essentially punishing people under these laws for reasons that have nothing to do with the purpose of the law. And then our final claim is a First Amendment claim. You know, you have a right to associate with your family members and not to be singled out because you're in a family with somebody who the government thinks, you know, is a quote unquote prolific offender.
So one of the most striking quotes in the Tampa Bay Times piece, which I commend to all listeners, to me was the deputy who summarized the purpose of the program as being, we want to harass these people until they move or sue. And the immediate reaction that I have to that is like, that seems like just this fundamentally illegitimate use of the police power. Does that factor into, does that way that they're using the law to try to get you to do something else, not just in the case of code enforcement, but to really drive people that they've deemed that they don't want around out of the county, does that factor into the legal claims or is that just too big to try to tackle in a single lawsuit?
No, that definitely factors into our due process claim as well. It's focused there. We're focused on the code enforcement, but we're also focused on the program more generally. And that you're, in the case of family members, you're punishing people for things that they think someone else might have done. But even in the case of people on the list, they're punishing people for things they haven't done yet and they may never do. And there's a definite due process problem with all of that.
So this program has gotten a lot of attention, from IJ, from others. The Southern Poverty Law Center commented on our case when we launched it. Ari, could you talk about the interest that the situation in Pasco is getting and what perspective the various groups that have investigated bring to it and how it's similar to IJ's perspective and maybe how it's different?
Sure. When the Tampa Bay Times article was making its rounds in public interest law firm circles. I think everybody had this collective sense that this has to be unconstitutional, but I think there was a little bit of head scratching about precisely what those claims would be. I think a lot of groups first seized on to the idea of gathering information and sharing information by the police and between the police and other governmental organizations, including the public schools. But I think what IJ is sort of uniquely intellectually oriented toward doing is crafting legal theories in a way that reflects our commitment to property rights. And for us, this, after a while, as Rob described, became more about a property rights issue than one involving information sharing on the part of the police. And I think that's important for a couple of reasons. One, because it gives us an opportunity to reaffirm a lot of the things that people sort of intuitively understand about the Fourth Amendment, which is that it protects your right to be free from government intrusion in the home. And at bottom, as Rob said, that's what this case is about. But secondarily, by framing this as a Fourth Amendment issue, it allows us to, I think, bring stronger claims and claims that are a little bit more powerful and more likely to be successful because we're not challenging the government's ability to make a list, for example, which it does all the time and sometimes can get away with and sometimes can't. We're certainly challenging the consequences of being on that list and the process or lack thereof in landing on it. And these are important questions and claims that we're excited about bringing. But I think IJ is uniquely situated to being able to turn this into a question about property rights in a way that perhaps other organizations that were looking at this issue aren't able to do. And many of these organizations are household names. And I think, nevertheless, IJ is the only group amongst those groups that's able to look at this and say, hey, this is a Fourth Amendment issue, and that's why IJ should be doing it.
It seems to me that perhaps for many of those groups, some of the low-hanging fruit in the program could also be, ironically, that discretion piece, where if you're saying that someone is a risk because of their background, but that opens up the potential for all sorts of potentially profiling based on race, based on class. Is that something that other groups have floated that IJ has considered, and if not, Why not?
So, I think the extent there's a problem with that way of thinking about it, and is that it's ultimately impossible to wring out of the system because if the government's going to make those kinds of biased decisions, they're going to make those kinds of biased decisions, and you can't judges can't stop them. You know, I mean, they can try, but they're, and maybe they should try, but they ultimately can't. And the way that you stop that kind of improper behavior is by setting bright lines that police can't cross, right? So you, what you say is, you know, you can't harass anybody in their home. And then, you know, it doesn't matter why they're harassing you in your home. You just can't do it. And that's a far more effective and ultimately enforceable way of ending that kind of harassment.
Trying to think about this from the perspective of someone, there must be someone, we've talked about all the people who are opposed. There must be someone out there who is in favor of this program, certainly the sheriff and potentially, you know, some others in his circles. Are there any arguments on its behalf? If you could say, as a, maybe a resident of Pasco, if you had a bunch of stuff stolen, does this work? Does it seem to actually be effective at all in preventing crimes or in bringing some other positive thing to the community that someone who maybe is on the fence would want to consider as they weigh, you know, just truly how bad is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are people out there who would try to make some sort of argument for why this program should exist and should continue to exist. Primarily, those people probably work for the Pasco County Sheriff's Office. But nevertheless, there are always going to be people in any scenario like this one who are going to say, hey, look, this works. And I think, first of all, it's questionable whether or not it does. But I think more importantly, we always need to not lose sight of the fact that efficacy does not drive constitutionality under the Fourth Amendment. And there are a great number of things that we could argue would be effective deterrents from criminal behavior that we would simply not put up with in a free society. And one of those things certainly has to be warrantless intrusions on private property and demanding to enter homes without the consent of those who live there. Those are things that we all sort of intuitively understand are protected by the Fourth Amendment. And so while I would maintain that this is all based primarily on junk science, for those out there who insist that it works, it nevertheless must be the case that efficacy doesn't drive constitutionality. And thankfully, I think we're right on that one in terms of the legal effectiveness of that argument.
There's also, in looking at this program, an interesting sort of very banal government program that has come to exist, continuing to exist, because it's almost a $3 million program that employs 30 people, right? So there's a strong incentive, even apart, it seems to me, even apart from the effectiveness of it, to keep it around because, well, you don't want to have to fire staff. You've got all this money allocated for it. And so you get to have, you get a little bit of this inertia within the department and within the government itself that kind of keeps it going, even if the results aren't there, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of, in many respects, the 9/11 effect. I mean, after, you know, you saw what the war on drugs kind of did for the militarization of the police and how that's, you know, now an inertia-driven thing that a lot of people are starting to wake up to and fight back against. And 9/11 was a similar type of event in that it empowered and established a surveillance system that now is itself a massive business. One of the things that we know about predictive policing in general is that this is not just something that's being done in-house. There are a lot of private contractors who are providing these services to police departments. There's a lot of staff that's been hired in order to administer these programs, and that's true in Pasco County. And that's part of the problem here. And so the best thing is always to stop a problem from getting even worse when it's still possible to do that. And that's what we're trying to do here.
We've talked earlier in discussing the legal claims about aspects in which this is something that hasn't really been challenged before. And so we were trying to figure out how to approach it. And it may be a little bit of a novel case in certain ways. Does that mean that the odds are stacked against us in court? And if so, you know, what does it mean if we succeed here? Or I guess conversely, if we don't, what is the result of that in the law? Because of the way we've structured this case.
Well, I always hate to, you know, handicap victory in my own cases. There's no, you know, either you're saying that you're going to lose or you're saying that you're going to win. And either sounds kind of bad.
Let's just say totally neutrally. What could happen if we win? What could happen if we lose?
Well, you know, actually, I mean, honestly, I do think that our Fourth Amendment claim in particular, I mean, all of our claims are strong and I think we'll win on all of our claims. But, you know, our Fourth Amendment claim in particular, you know, it's intuitive and it fits with the text of the amendment. It follows from the precedents, and we're just right about, I mean, we're right about everything. But to me, that claim, I would be shocked if we don't win. But, you know, hey, I've been wrong before. You know, look, though, I in terms of the consequences of the decision here, I mean, you know, there are other cities that have adopted these types of programs, including, you know, Chicago and Los Angeles both adopted them and then, you know, abandoned them because they realized they're not effective. You know, in the Pasco Sheriff's Office is putting this forward, you know, their materials say, like, this is supposed to be a model for other cities. And we know other cities are looking at it. We know that this is something that, you know, appreciative policing is controversial, but it's also an attractive idea to law enforcement. So there's huge stakes here. And I think, you know, beyond even just this type of specific program, there's also just a sort of more broad trend in law enforcement that I think law enforcement is, you know, attracted to this idea that we're going to go out and we're going to stop crime before it happens. And that is not necessarily a bad thing if it's done in the right way. But what we're saying in this case is that if you're going to do that, you have to respect individual liberties. And you can't sweep aside people's individual civil rights just because you think that they might someday commit a crime. And, you know, I think it's the disregard for that principle that in many ways has made predictive policing so dangerous and so ineffective and has caused it to drive a wedge between police departments and the communities that they're supposed to be serving. And, you know, what we're really doing here is we're saying, you know, it's fine. You want to gather information. I mean, obviously there are limits on that, but you can do it. You want to be smart. You want to make a list. Sure, you can do that. But what you have to do is you have to be very careful about how you operationalize that. And you have to do that in a way that respects constitutional rights.
Last thing I wanted to ask about before we conclude the conversation, since we filed the lawsuit, what has been the reaction of others from the allies and other groups who were interested in the program and its problems, people in the county beyond, and of course, what has the sheriff's office had to say about it?
Well, on a community level, it seems as though folks are certainly behind us. People who live in Pasco County were well aware of the behavior of the Pasco County Sheriff's Office. And so I think folks generally thought it was high time that somebody did something about this program. Pasco County Sheriff's Office has taken a slightly different tack, having first said they won't litigate the case in the media and then sort of sneakily providing false information about our clients to members of the media, without publishing it in the form of a traditional press release. And so, you know, it's unfortunate. It's not super surprising, but we're looking forward, of course, to getting the Pasco County Sheriff's Office into court and being able to do this the right way. And they say that's what they want to do too. So that'll all be fun once we get to it.
And of course, we can't close this without mentioning the statement that the sheriff put out where they vehemently denied that they are attempting to implement the movie Minority Report.
So they said it first, right?
Yeah. If you have to say it.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe it's the first thing that comes to mind for everyone. All right. Well, thank you both for joining me. And thank you to everyone for listening. If you enjoyed this discussion and want to hear more like it, you can find more episodes of Deep Dive wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube. And don't forget to subscribe.